Let's start with a prayer, and then I'll tell you what we're going to do next. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda. Bless us and guide us. That is the prayer that we always offer. Bless us and guide us. For we live in this world according to our own samskars, our own past impressions, and we long to be free of all of the bondage of our past karma, and to be able to feel your guiding presence and have the clarity and courage to respond to it. Bless us and guide us, that we may live always in your light. Om. Peace. Amen. So, last session, just before Christmas, we finished what we had been working with, which was the final exam. We were talking about the process of leaving this body and from the point of view of consciousness. And and then we went through the astral ascension ceremony, which was really lovely. And so now we're ready to start with something new. So I thought of a topic that has been of great interest to people, and it's the question of how to live intuitively. So that's the series we're starting now, Living Intuitively. And I'm basing what I'm going to be talking to you about, and I suspect it will take us quite some many days to go through this. Many years ago, Swami Kriyananda gave a class. It may have been called How to Know and Trust Your Inner Guidance. That's a title that I've used for many years, and it may have started with him, as many things do, as everything does. He gave what to my mind was a definitive class on that subject. How to tell what is true intuition, how to develop true intuition. I took notes on it in this folder, which I've been carrying around in my life for decades, and using it as the, as the template for talking about this class. I'm on a quest to find the recording of Swami's original class. Fortunately, the treasures along the path section, department of Ananda Worldwide, Nyaswami Krishna works incredibly thoroughly. She's been doing it for many years now to get all the audio recordings that were on tape onto digital form, and she's just an encyclopedia. So I wrote to her and I told her what I knew about this class, because I really don't even know. I have vague ideas about when it might have been given. She thought she might have it. So if we find it, I'll certainly post a link to it so that you all can also draw from it. I'll be interested to see all these decades later sort of what it feels like, what of what I'm saying is actually what Swami said, and what of it is what I've been developing over all these years. So in any case, we're going to start right in. And the subject is, I had reduced Swami's class, which I believe was about 2 hours long, into 22 points of the positive and the negatives about what blocks intuition and then what facilitates it. The notes are written from my own thinking, so at this point at least they're not in publishable form, but I'll probably try to go through it and just make some kind of a checklist if I feel that would be beneficial. Sometimes when you reduce things down too far, they're not as helpful as they could be, which is the reason why PowerPoint sometimes is a really bad idea. They said that one of the NASA disasters was because of PowerPoint, because things that were much too subtle to be reduced to 5 bullet points were compelled to be reduced to 5 bullet points. And then people started losing track of what was really happening. So I'm not I'm both a curmudgeon because I'm older, and also I'm not a fan of taking subtle ideas and insisting that they can be listed in threes and fives. However, I do have 22 points, so we'll see what happens. So, the basic idea that I'm wanting to talk about, the basic theme that we're talking about, is that when we live in this world, there's so much confusing input. And when we live inside our own consciousness, which we all do unless we are liberated, in which case you're not listening to this class, we have so many different impulses within us that the great challenge is, you say, listen to your inner voice or even listen to your heart, but your heart speaks from many different perspectives, and our inner voice is not a voice. It's a small army of different voices that alternately compete for dominance. And depending on the day of the week or what you had for lunch or whether you had an argument with someone close to you or whether you're feeling a little out of sorts or if your hormone levels have shifted for one reason or another, this, you know, strong inner force comes and it can be extremely persuasive. So the first premise of if we do think of how to know and trust your higher guidance is that when we speak about the inner voice, it's a choir. It's not a soloist. At a certain point in our spiritual evolution, it becomes a soloist. But it's for most of us, there's a lot of stages as we go along. And even when we feel, and it may prove to be true, that we have actually attuned to the right voice in the choir, even what you do with it after that also has a huge influence on whether or not it works out in a way that moves you toward the light or still leads to inner confusion. Just how I feel is extremely relevant and is the core of what we're doing, but how I feel yesterday and how I feel today. Just a week ago, I was involved in some issues about finances of all things, which is by no means my strong suit. I'm good at prosperity, but money per se is not something that I necessarily get really easily. I'm learning, but it's not something that I was born knowing. And I just had, some very clear feelings about things, which I don't have anymore because they were how I felt and it was relevant. And I sort of played it out for a while and then new information came in and that new information began to shift. And so now I'm somewhere else completely. But I've learned mostly to give things a little time, that if it's really a divinely inspired idea, I don't have to be in a hurry. It'll keep coming back to me. Now, everything I know about guidance I learned from Swamiji. I learned from watching him and listening to him and having him talk. I refer to this class, but it was also just from watching him over many years, so I'm going to refer to a lot of that. So, point number one, if I'm going to go through 22 here, point number one is the greatest obstacle to really understanding our inner guidance is that we are not neutral. We are affirming our neutrality. We are affirming our surrender, and that is what we ought to do. We need to understand what the right attitude would be. And we need to constantly be measuring ourselves against what the right attitude is. We should be working with ourselves to try to make that right attitude an authentic expression of how we should feel. But we should also be very conscious of the fact that it's a very high level of spiritual advancement to really be neutral. In fact, Patanjali, I'll have to explain what I mean by neutral. By neutral, let me put it, it's like what I mean by neutral, yes, of course, neutral means I don't have preferences, and that's also part of it. But of course, you know, we have preferences for light over darkness. We have preferences for the creation and the expression of a beautiful potential rather than having that potential be sabotaged by small-minded people. It's absurd to say that we're just completely neutral in the sense of not being able to discern light from darkness. So neutral is more like, or another way to think about neutral is when you would shift a car into neutral. Now, most of us have cars that are automatic these days, so we're not so used to how it used to be, where you come out of one gear and then the car, you could just put the pedal to the floor, but there were no gears engaged, and so it would just spin, nothing, there would be no movement. And then you would have to put in the clutch and move it to another gear, and then the gears would engage, and when you added the fuel, then it would move. So the neutral that we're talking about in our spiritual life, when I say it in that sense, is that everything is engaged, but we're not choosing a direction. We're using all the potential energy that's right there, using the car image, where it could really move forward and go fast. It's all there. But in the moment, we don't have any of the gears engaged, so we're completely attentive, we're listening, we're waiting to know what we're supposed to do. The thing about that gear, and I don't think the car image carries it all the way through, it's an exceedingly dynamic state. Because in such a moment, there may be a tremendous necessity. We know there's going to be a necessity to take action. It may even be very, very important. Something very important has to happen. And we're poised and ready with all of the creative energy and all the dynamic will that we may have, but we're using our willpower to hold ourselves perfectly still rather than using our willpower to move powerfully and often to restrain what might even be a very intense desire to take action uses everything we have. Holding still is a tremendous action. This is when you get into the Bhagavad Gita about action, inaction, 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 and just all those different words. It's because of the willpower required to quiet the mind. And in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, he defines yoga itself as the neutralization of all these waves of citta. And citta is the feeling aspect. Now, what we understand about the feeling aspect, the way we want to think about it now, it is likes and dislikes. It's you know, it's love or aversion, attraction and aversion. It's all those opposites. But the feeling aspect is also that aspect which compels us to action. Swami uses the image a lot of times. If you're living even right across the street from one of the best restaurants in the world and you've read the reviews and you see the menu and you know what a nice room they have over there for you to go in and sit down and have one of their super classy meals. But if you're not hungry, all that information is just information because there's no compelling energy within you that makes you, that compels you to action. Now, being and citta, that kind of compels to action, can be divinely inspired, and it can also just be a thousand other samskaras that are just moving us. I was talking to friends recently about this. It's a very interesting phenomenon, and the restrictions of this pandemic over the last few months, isn't that interesting? The last few years, you know, ever since I was a wee lass, I've been confined to quarters is what it feels like sometimes. But the compelling restrictions of the quarantine that I've been under fairly strictly since March because of my age and also because of the position I'm in, I've had to keep a sort of clean room space so that we can keep broadcasting without putting anyone in jeopardy. The concept of consciousness, the reality that has always been true, that we're always living within our inner consciousness, and that is it's the only place where any problem can be solved. It's much more vivid to me. And I received a Christmas card from a friend, and it was a family newsletter, and she had chosen a quote from Master to put onto that newsletter, which I love, and I've now put it where I can see it every day. Live quietly in the moment with an appreciation for the beauty all around you, or the beauty in everything around you. The future will take care of itself. I mean, now, yeah, I could have said that. Well, meaning it's not like the idea itself is completely unknown, but it's amazing sometimes how ideas will just strike you in the moment. And I have to observe in my own life, this is a struggle I've had my whole life, because I'm a little, I use the phrase high-strung, which I think is a nice way to put it. It's a euphemism for a lot of other things that sound less attractive when I would say them. But being a little bit high-strung, I've had an inclination, everyone has an inclination, to imagine what might happen and become anxious about it and then try to do something about it. I was speaking to two friends, both of whom are my generation, who have serious health issues, and the tendency for them and for the people who love them to project into the future and try to make something happen. When you have no opportunity, no equipment, no knowledge, no intuition, no reliable intuition, but still, there's just this desire to agitate. And that's the opposite of being neutral. That's the opposite of doing what needs to be done in the moment and realize that the future will take care of itself. And in simple words, these are likes and dislikes, where our happiness has become dependent, we believe, on certain things taking place. Now, when we're going now to intuition, and when we're really talking about divine intuition, not just what feels right to me. See, the problem of what feels right to us is that the human ego has a tremendous preference for the familiar and has a tremendous preference for that which it can analyze and anticipate and know how I'm going to take care of it. And the divine has a preference for expansion and the nature for expanding our consciousness. The divine preference is that we expand our consciousness. The egoic preference is that things not become too difficult or too challenging or too sad. In other words, that things I think I need, I may lose. And so my preference, my likes and my dislikes are based on being able to control it and keep it recognizably where I am right now. Now, of course, we can advance to a higher level, but I remember, and I, you know, it's nice, many of the things that I remember, my memories of Swamiji are all positive. But many of the things I did, embarrassing might be a simple word for it. That's kind of a word like high strung. It's like embarrassing, mortifying, unbelievable that I could actually have said or done something like that. And it's true. But it's nice also because sometimes I remember things that I did and I realize I would never do that again. Look, I've grown. You know, it's very hard sometimes to see how we grow. One of the reasons why it's hard to see how we grow is because once you become someone else, you're no longer who you were. And the one that you become is so natural to you that we often just sort of lose the cycle. We lose track of who I used to be because I'm not that person anymore, so we don't see it, we don't relate to it. But I remember actually saying to Swamiji that he ought not to use the word challenge so often because it was scary to people. It wasn't scary to people, it was scary to me. This was when I was, you know, really there, and Ananda, just really dedicated, really doing everything I could, but I was high-strung and nervous. And the word challenge was not a good word to me. And then I hear myself now just talking very casually about challenges, just very easily and casually. And I think, why did I ever say that? But I did. I mean, one of the reasons I remember it is because Swami had this marvelous way, which is something really worth emulating, this marvelous way of not agreeing with you at all, but at the same time not rejecting you for what you said. At least that's how he would work with me. So he would listen as if my idea actually had merit, and it would only be when I would observe that he absolutely paid no attention to it after that that I would gather what he really felt. But he never judged. He would just observe and accept and listen and sort of, I know he projected a lot of it. He was giving me more than I was able to receive at times. But his way of thinking about it was simply, oh, look, she has something to learn. But not like, oh, boy, she has something to learn. It was, oh, okay, she's showing me what her consciousness is. She's opening her consciousness to me. Okay, let's see what we can do with this. You know, just like these are the ingredients. It's fun to cook if you can make a grocery list and you go to the best stores and you buy all the best ingredients and then you make the perfect meal. I also think it's great fun to just open the refrigerator and the cabinets and like, what is dinner? What's in here? And there's no judgment about what is and isn't in there. It's just like, we have to make dinner and this is what's in the cabinet, so this is what we're going to do. And that's how Swamiji was always working with us. We need to make a saint, because that was his job, was to turn us into saints. And these are the raw materials. So we're going to have to find a recipe for sainthood based on what's already in the refrigerator. So when I would say, incomparably amusing in retrospect, idiotic things to him, he would just observe it as just one more ingredient that we were just going to have to somehow, one more thread, if you want to think of it, weave into the tapestry that was eventually going to be pure light. So my aversion, my anxiety about being challenged too far was a part of my nature. So I had a tremendous preference for intuitions that would not be too hard to follow. Now, the thing we have to understand also about intuition and why the likes and dislikes are such a big deal is that it's not as if, let's see, now nowadays you don't really have radio in the way you used to, although I guess it still exists. I hear it in the car. I listen to NPR in the car. And whatever program is on at that particular time when I'm in the car, that's the only one that I can listen to. I'm sure I could hook up my phone and do something, but I don't. So in other words, I have the feeling that there's only certain times when certain ideas are going to be projected. There's certain storytelling that I like. There's some science programs that I find interesting, you know, blah, blah, like that. Too much politics, I don't care to hear. But at certain times, certain information will be projected, and at other times I'm out of luck. And because we live in a world of time, in a world of where space and matter limit us, we tend to project that same image onto God and Guru. So we think that God is only speaking to us sometimes. But the fact of the matter is, and this is just, you have to really try to think this through, God is eternal, God is immutable, God is unconditioned, God, Guru, angel, whatever words work for you. That means it's always the same. There is no change in the infinite. Well, it's ever new. These are wonderful words we can meditate on. It's ever new, but he's not like sometimes he's more loving to us and sometimes he's not. Sometimes he's there for us and sometimes he's not. Like a professor, the office hours, and the rest of the time the professor's not in his office. So God does not keep appointment times and he has no secretary. He's always present, and Guru's guidance is exactly available at all times to us. It's we who go in and out of listening. So we go in and out of listening because we are subject to the up and down waves of the world of duality. And we'll have times when we're tremendously receptive, and we'll have other times when we're too worried or too busy or too rebellious, just not interested. A friend of mine, well, in the early years of Ananda Village, when we were just a handful of people, 30, 50, I don't know what the actual numbers were, even within the community of 100 people, only about half of us were really connected to what Swami was doing, and over time, the population would shift. Those who weren't connected to what Swami was doing eventually found reasons to move on. They were good people. It's just this, it wasn't their destiny. So, and we all lived together on this land together. We all knew each other's business all the time. Many of us did not have automobiles. We had no money. There was no place to go. So we were just always there. And when events would happen, that core group would always be present. And Swami himself gave a Kriya initiation. He was the only one at that time who did. And one of the core Ananda members just didn't show up. And in the isolated way that we lived, even in our own homes without telephones or anything like that, you know, a person could become very sick and no one would know. So Swami was very concerned that this man had not shown up for the initiation. So he asked me to go the next morning and knock on his door and just make sure he was okay. So I knocked on his door. He was a friend. I said, "Swami noticed, we all noticed your absence last night. Swamiji was concerned. He sent me over to find out why you didn't come. This man, God bless him, absolutely straight shooter. He never pretended. He said, I didn't feel like bowing down to the gurus last night." Just like that. I said, "Oh, okay." You know, because it was truth. You can speak as long as it's true. I don't care what you say. It's always been my philosophy. I don't function well if I don't get the truth. But if I get the truth, that's just one of the ingredients in the refrigerator. We're just going to work with it. Learned it from Swami. So I went back to Swami and I told him. Swami laughed. He said, "Yeah, I understand that. I feel that way sometimes myself." And he was just like, "Yeah, that's just who he is. That's, you know, that's just what we're going to do." So there are times when I don't really want to know what the guru wants. I just want to know what I want, like that. Fortunately, wanting to know what the guru wants is a stronger impulse in my life and that man's life. But there are days. But that doesn't mean that the guru has stopped speaking to us. It just means, like little children, when you don't want to know something, you'll start making noise and putting your hands over your ears, like that, so that I won't have to hear what you're saying to me. Or like little babies, if they cover their eyes and they can't see you, they think they've become invisible. But the guru is like the tambura in the Indian music, exactly. It's just always playing. So divine intuition is not hard to hear from the divine side. The divine intuition is hard to hear from the human side because we're always moving in and out of our attunement. And what moves us in and out is the duality that we ourselves live with. You know, this is what I want today, but that's what I want tomorrow. This is what I'm afraid of today, and this is what I have to do tomorrow. We prefer to stay in something that we feel we can control, that we understand, and that's preferably familiar. And yes, of course, even I mean, something big and hard happens. It's an opportunity. And what God wants is for us to grow. So if we're constantly trying to get God to tell us that it's okay to stay small, there's really not much he can say. It's like when I say to Swami, don't use the word challenge. He can look at me and be very loving and sympathetic, but he actually literally has nothing to say. I had that same conversation with Swami many years later when I said to him, if life weren't so difficult, it would be easier. That perhaps is my famous idiotic remark to him. And his expression, I so wish I could have had a camera. In India, they have this way of nodding their heads and they go, acha, acha, like this. Perhaps it's just a Bengali thing like this. And when we first went to India, Swamiji, what does this mean? He says, it means I exist, you exist. It's like absolutely no commitment. We're just acknowledging that we're both alive and we're conscious beings and we're just here. And that's sort of with Swami, when I said that to him, he didn't nod his head like that. He just sat there, but there was absolutely nothing he could do except simply exist with me in the same time-space frame because nothing else could be said like that. He had much that he could have said, but I had put my hands over my ears and I was making noise so I didn't have to hear him. So that's the first obstacle to hearing guidance, is that our ears are closed. So what we have to do is we just have to open our ears, and that's where we'll start tomorrow. God bless you, my friends.